Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin, broadcasting from the Center for Science and Culture with the Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. And we have again in our studio today with us a special guest, Dr. Paul Nelson, who has been on a couple of recent podcasts discussing the question of common descent and intelligent design and the scientific data and where he thinks that it leads. And we have him back in the studio today. Dr. Nelson, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks again, Casey.
Can you just, again, remind our listeners, what is your academic background? Where did you come from before you came here?
I was an undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh, where I studied evolutionary biology and genetics and the philosophy of science. I then went to the University of Chicago in the philosophy program, where I looked in my dissertation at Darwin's theory of common descent. I wrote on the way that this theory influences or interacts with other parts of our biological knowledge, which, both from a philosophical and biological standpoint, is a deeply interesting question. Typically, in their professional work, biologists aren't conscious of the role of the theory of common descent in their thinking. They view it as part of the furniture of reality. It's just the way the world is. In fact, if you were to ask them, well, here's a sort of simple test that one can do. Ask a biologist if he knows of a colleague who has skepticism about the role of natural selection in evolutionary explanation, and he won't have any problem naming half a dozen people right off the top of his head. Stephen Gould famously had doubts about
Lynn Margulis,
yes, another person. Brian Goodwin and so forth. It's an easy list to populate. Then ask that person, do you know of any evolutionary biologist who doubts Darwin's tree of life, namely the view that all living things share common ancestry? And chances are he'll look at you like you made a bad joke. It would be like asking an astronomer, can you tell me someone in your community, astronomical community, who thinks that the sun goes around the earth? That's what I mean when I say they view it as part of the furniture of reality. It's just the case that all living things share common ancestry, that Darwin's tree was established as fact in the 19th century, and we've had no reason to doubt it up to today. One of the things I've discovered in my work about the theory of common descent is just how diverse opinion has been about the single tree picture from the 19th century to the present. And in fact, how much within the past decade, many evolutionary biologists are now saying, you know what, maybe there never was a universal common ancestor, an organism to which all living things trace their ancestry. Something that I never could have expected as a student.
So this questioning of whether there is an organism, where does that come from? I mean, I know that in recent years, there's been a lot of talk about what's going on at the root of the tree of life. Is there a last common ancestor, a last universal common ancestor, or is it more like a last universal common gene pool, or is it multiple origins of life? And there's all these different ideas. Can you sort this out? This is above the level, you know, the origin of the genetic code that we've talked about recently, but at the, you know, the level of the major domains of life. What's going on there, and what are evolutionary biologists saying?
Well, first let me describe the major domains. The idea that life is divided into three main domains comes from the work of Carl Woese at the University of Illinois, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and someone who thinks a great deal about this question of the structure of the early history of life, or the relationships that existed at the early history of life. The three domains are eukarya, that is, organisms with a nucleus, archaea, which are interesting single-celled organisms that lack a nucleus but otherwise share many features with eukarya, and bacteria, sometimes called eubacteria. These are also single-celled organisms that diverge strikingly from both eukarya and archaea in terms of their molecular features. And it was Woese who was largely responsible for erecting this three-domain hypothesis. And typically when the three domains are illustrated in a diagram, they're shown as linked by their three branches come together at a node that links them all, And that node is then identified as the last universal common ancestor, or as it's sometimes abbreviated, LUCA, L-U-C-A. You can think of LUCA on this view as your ultimate grandparent.
I actually think that in Ewok it is the word for ultimate grandparent. So why are some evolutionary biologists starting to doubt this single tree picture?
I think it's helpful to think about what the single tree picture predicts. You begin with this single cell, the ur-parent, the ultimate ancestor to all living things. It's going to have a fair amount of hardware. It'll have, for instance, probably, almost certainly, DNA, RNA, and protein. Those molecular features are found in all living things. It's going to have some way of converting the information in nucleic acid, namely DNA and RNA, into protein, so it'll have a genetic code. It'll have metabolic pathways. It will have transport pathways. It'll have genes involved in cell division and so forth. So you'll have a kind of minimal set of basic molecular hardware necessary to be a cell at all. And some of those bits of hardware are going to be absolutely essential. That is, you can't take them away and have the cell still exist. Now, if you think about that, in order for a cell to reproduce, to make more copies of itself, that essential hardware will have to be passed on to the offspring. And from that kind of picture, one can generate some predictions. The genetic code, for instance, the means by which information is transferred from the realm of nucleic acid into the realm of protein, that's a pretty essential bit of information, a pretty essential feature. It's likely to be inherited by every organism from the original ancestor forward. Genes involved in maintaining the basic biochemistry of the cell, both metabolic and informational, those are also likely to be maintained because they're so important. So you begin to get an expectation or a prediction that if one examines a cell, let's say from some new bacterial group not previously seen, maybe you've isolated it from a hot spring in Yellowstone mm-hmm. and so forth, that the features, the molecular features of those cells, the essential molecular features, that is, will likely be the same as those found in E. coli, the bacteria that populate the gut of any healthy adult. Well, here's what happened. In the mid-90s, DNA sequencing became automated such that it was possible to generate sequence data mapping the DNA of organisms, prokaryotes in particular, very, very rapidly. And instead of looking at single genes or single proteins, now biologists were able to look at all the genes and proteins possessed by different kinds of prokaryotes and compare that to what they expected from the theory of common descent. And it turned out that rather than genes and proteins falling into a neat hierarchical tree, as one might expect from the theory of common descent, there was a wild sort of patchwork of distribution of genes and proteins that prima facie actually refutes the theory of common descent. If you hold the theory of common descent strictly to its predictions, this wild patchwork of distribution where a gene would seem to be completely out of place with respect to where it ought to be in terms of its ancestry, or a protein found not where you expect it, but in a completely unrelated group, prima facie, that looks like a falsification of the prediction of the theory. But evolutionary theory has lots of possibilities.
Sure, and this goes back to, I don't mean to interrupt you, this was sounding very good, but this goes back to something we talked about in a previous podcast, where when you find data that really contradicts what a theory predicts, what do you do? Does that theory pay the price, or do you invent some ad hoc explanation? So what happened here when this data was discovered? Did the theory of common descent essentially pay the price, or was some ad hoc explanation brought in to account for the data? Ad hoc, of course, meaning sort of an additional level of explanation that is sort of meant to explain away why the data doesn't fit.
Well, I think that we need to recognize that there are processes that go on in prokaryotic populations, in bacteria, for instance, that we don't really see in animals or even complex eukaryotes. For instance, bacteria are able to swap DNA horizontally or laterally. That is, not in terms of vertical reproduction, where the cell splits and has daughter cells and so forth, but convey genes, sort of swapping them, passing them from one cell to another by various mechanisms. And, for instance, this is a well-known phenomenon with antibiotic resistance, that most bacteria that become resistant to antibiotics don't evolve the resistance themselves. Rather, they pick it up on a plasmid, a piece of little circular DNA that's passed to them from another cell, by horizontal or lateral gene transfer. So there are processes in prokaryotes where information can move very rapidly, sort of through prokaryotic organismal space, and that provides a possible mechanism for evolution to explain these anomalous patterns of distribution of genes and proteins. So what happened, to get back to your question, in the mid-90s, when these anomalies popped up, these puzzling phylogenetic or evolutionary distributions of genes and proteins, the possibility that a great deal of lateral transfer occurred early in the history of life was given a tremendous boost. It would be interesting, in fact, to graph over time the frequency of the term lateral or horizontal gene transfer in evolutionary publications beginning in the mid-90s. My guess is that it would rise quite dramatically. So one response to these puzzles was to say, well, common descent is still true. There still was a universal common ancestor to the whole tree of life. But the early history of the tree of life, rather than representing a neatly bifurcating tree where branches come off in a nice regular way, in fact, is a kind of wild network of horizontal transmission of genetic information, much more resembling a net or a network with lots of nodes all interrelating in various ways than it would, a nice clean oak tree. But what happened then is some investigators began to say, well, maybe this whole idea of an original ancestor, that cell that was the ur-parent, the original parent to us all, maybe that, in fact, has to go as well. And what they did is to say, probably a better representation of the early history of life with respect to these puzzles that we see from whole genome sequencing is that the early history of life was this wildly promiscuous, hard to understand period when you didn't really have cellular lineages as we now observe them, but in fact a kind of communal soup in which organisms, hard to describe, but there were organisms there, were exchanging genetic information rampantly, and out of that...
Bacteria gone wild, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely not for 18 years old or younger viewing. Out of that soup emerge the major domains, but there never was an organism that was ancestral to all of life. Now, I have some problems with this picture. One of them is it's hard for me to imagine on its face what you might call pre-cellular life. All living things that we know, without exception, are cellular. Humans are multicellular. We have trillions of cells. But even the simplest free-living bacteria that we've been able to isolate have a clear membrane that isolates them from the rest of the environment. They don't let just anything pass that membrane. They don't let just anything out. What this world would have been like with sort of pre-cellular life, I think, is largely, at this point, speculation. But I want to be fair. These are the hypotheses that are out there.
Okay. So, current state of the field. Maybe I'll throw something out. You can tell me where I'm wrong. The consensus that's sort of forming is that this common descent at the base of the tree of life really doesn't fit with the data. But they haven't given up on sort of tracing these basic groups, these three domains of life, to a last common group of gene-swapping microorganisms from which all other life did descend. So the last common ancestor is not in vogue. It's now the last common gene pool, perhaps. And is that sort of where things are at today?
Well, I need to stress that the position I'm describing is largely associated with the molecular evolutionist W. Ford Doolittle, who is at Dalhousie University in Canada, Carl Woese at the University of Illinois, and several others, but it still remains a minority position within evolutionary theory.
But nonetheless, it seems from what you're saying, Paul, is that there was a prediction of the theory of common descent that all life would, you know, sort of fit into this nice nested hierarchy of genes and proteins, and it didn't fit. So is that a fair statement?
Well, let me just end with this comment. We are looking at a period now in biology where the diversity of the genetic universe is turning out to be very much greater than anyone could have guessed. Mm. Craig Venter, the geneticist who spearheaded the Human Genome Sequencing Project, over the past few years has sailed a boat around the world sampling from ocean waters looking for DNA, and he's found an amazing variety of genetic sequences, none of which have been seen before. Mm. And it appears that the genetic universe may extend indefinitely beyond our horizons right now. An absolutely remarkable finding.
Mm. Wow. Well, we're going to continue this discussion in future podcasts. This is, again, Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Hosting in the studio today, Dr. Paul Nelson. We will be continuing this. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.